are here.
We are here. We are here. We will fight for freedom, for movement, for everyone's right.
To see all of you people, to be honest, I've never stood in front of so many people in my life. They say that we are going to close the borders, but what they don't understand is, if I came all the way back from Somalia, do you know how many kilometers or miles is that? To stand in front of you right now, right here, tell me which borders or crescents or whatever you want to call it can actually stop me being here today. The reality is, it's not up to you. It's not up to anybody. It is my right to live. It is my right to breathe. This world is not for nobody, it is for everybody.
Yeah.
And if you cannot see that, if you cannot stand, understand that point, then that's why you are lost. We are here and we will fight for our rights, for freedom, for movement.
For life.
Because this is about my life. It is the fact, a simple fact, that I am supposed to live. I did not choose to be in Somalia. I did not choose to be in Netherlands. But I chose to live. The thing is, it's not a matter of trying to keep us outside. We are already here. Right here in Amsterdam, in every street in the Netherlands, in Belgium, in Germany, in the whole of Europe. What does that tell you? It tells you that where there is a will, there is a way. And I have all the will to live. Nobody is going to stop that.
Welcome to an English episode of De Verbranders, a podcast on Europe's borders and resistance against them. I am Wiebe Ruitenberg.
And I'm Neske Baarwald.
De Verbranders is Dutch for Harriga, an Arabic word used in Morocco, Tunisia, and Algeria. Harriga literally means those who burn, and is used to speak of people who cross European borders without permission. It refers to the burning of identity papers. So those who do harriga burn Europe's borders. Our guest today is Mariama Omar. You just listened to fragments of a speech she gave in 2016 at one of the demonstrations of We Are Here, a group of people who have been moving around Amsterdam since 2012 to protest Dutch immigration policies. We talked to Mariama about We Are Here and her role as a public speaker, and about how the Netherlands treats people like her. After fighting for many years, Mariama was finally granted asylum. In this episode, she describes how exhausting it is to fight the Dutch system, and how dehumanizing it is to be excluded by law and policy, and to be framed as an intruder or criminal by politicians and media. She also talks about the people and organizations that reached out to We Are Here in the name of help, but actually more so for their own projects, that more often than not were not helpful at all. And she emphasizes that, despite it all, she will live, because as she says in the speech, her living is not up to anyone. We are curious about your thoughts. Leave a comment on our Instagram or Twitter, or email us at deverbranderspodcast@gmail.com. If you want to know more about We Are Here, have a look at their website, wijzijnhier.org. And listen to our episodes with Sin and Joyce, who have been supporting the people We Are Here for years, and Sami Tsegaya, who is still a part of We Are Here.
Welcome, Mariama. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you.
So could you talk a little bit about yourself and how you got involved with We Are Here?
Wow. How did I get involved in We Are Here? I was actually in SSA Alkmaar. My whole procedure was shut down and they wanted to deport me to DTNVA. I don't know how to say that in full, so I'm sorry about that.
Dienst terugkeer en vertrek.
That one, yes. And they wanted to deport me, but that could not happen. So I stayed almost 3 months in jail. But then I got released, and then I started my procedure again. But then it ended. And when it ended, I was put on the street. So I didn't know where to go. Then I had a friend from another SSA who was in We Are Here. So I called her and then she said, well, we are in this place with this group called We Are Here. So if you want to join us, you can come there. So that's basically how I came to the We Are Here, the end of 2014.
So when you first joined We Are Here, what was it like for you to join?
To be honest with you, I was in a very low point of my life and I didn't know what to do and I didn't know where to go or whom to ask help because some of the help that I asked for, I did not get it. So when I came to the We Are Here, I felt hopeless and I felt like I was some piece of paper, you know? Because everywhere that I ask help for, all they see is that, do you have this paper or do you have this document? No. Then if you don't have it, then we will not give you this help. It was really dehumanizing. And yeah, it really broke my heart in a lot of ways. So I was brokenhearted and I was emotionally really distressed when I came to the We Are Here and they welcomed me. The first, I think, month or something, I was not speaking or anything like that. I was really in a very bad place. But then whatever food we get, they will cook and then they will bring me and then we will eat together. And in a way, they recuperated me. And that is how I found a community. And little by little, I felt, well, at least you are not alone in this godforsaken place. So that's how I became part of the group. Yeah.
And can you talk a little bit more about We Are Here and its political goals?
Well, I will talk about the way I see We Are Here, my perspective. Here are people who are in a country where you are basically stuck in a limbo. You don't have housing. You don't have health insurance. You cannot work. You cannot study. You cannot function as a way a human being is supposed to function in any society. And because of that, people just get stuck in some kind of a dimension within this reality. And you don't see it. So because of that, people, I don't know how it actually came together, but somehow they found each other and then they started the whole group. And the purpose to me was to say, hey, I'm not going to stay in this limbo and you are not going to pretend that I don't exist. I do exist. I am here. I'm in front of you and I'm here to fight for my rights. You're not going to ignore me. I'm a human being. You're not going to dehumanize me by making me some kind of a statistics on paper. So that is how it came. That is how I see it. For me, it was to survive and to just be fed up, say, enough is enough. You're not going to treat me this way. Yeah.
So after some time, you became one of the leaders and you took on a more public role as well. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like and what you did in that role as well?
To be honest, it wasn't anything that I was aspiring for. It's just something that just I find myself in it. They wanted a lot of women to speak up, especially in the demonstration. And at the time, there was one girl, her name was Ilham, who was also speaking at the demonstration. But then they said, okay, we would like also if there is another voice, a female voice, who can also add to her voice. And I was asked about it. I was like, oh, well, what am I gonna speak? And they were like, hey, you're just gonna say what you need to say about your situation. So without even thinking that much, okay, fine. You know, I'm kind of like an easygoing kind of person. So I was like, okay, fine. But then I remember that day when I was called in the stage and there's all these people, like over 3,000 or something people. Oh my God. That's when I realized I should not have said, okay. Yeah, I should have said, oh no, I'm not going to speak. But then I just spoke how I felt in my heart and how the situation was affecting me personally. And then from there, for some reason, the whole speech became kind of viral. And then everybody was like, yeah, you should speak with her. You should speak with her. You should speak. I'm like, why ever? Yeah, but we like you. We like the way you speak. We like the way you think. So you should take the lead. And I've always fighted, you know, people putting me in that leader role because I never liked it. But then at this time, when the women called me and then they said, listen, we don't speak. Our English is not that good, some of the women. And we like the way you reason, the way you speak, because you speak from your heart. We want you to speak for us. And I had to, because in a way, they were my family, you know? They helped me when I didn't had any help. So I saw them as my family. And because of that, then I have accepted the role, even though it was not a role that I wanted.
I can imagine it's also quite a lot of responsibility.
Yeah, it was. It really was. Because I get called by the social media. I get called by people who want to donate. I get calls from students who just want to have some kind of interview. I mean, I was getting calls from everywhere. And even when I don't answer my calls, because sometimes I will just switch off my telephone, people come looking for me. So it was really exhausting. And on top of that, you have to motivate people to come and demonstrate day by day. You have to tell them we have to do it. Even though sometimes nothing tangible comes out of it. You know, our situation is not changing it day by day, day by day. But you have to tell them we have to do it. We have to do it for the hope of tomorrow. And sometimes that hope is far away and you don't know what to do right now. Because right now is where you need to be recuperating, you know, and it's exhausting. It takes all the energy. It takes your light. It takes your integrity. It takes everything from you being in that kind of situation. You cry by yourself. If you are scared, you're scared by yourself. Because a lot of times, you cannot speak about these things because how am I going to speak to someone who's also in the same situation with me? You know, of course, I understand that she is with me in this place, but on the other hand, she's also feeling the same way, you know, or he's also feeling the same way. And on top of that, there's all this negativity around what the media says or another politician who just want to instigate more anger in people so that he can get more votes. And on top of that, you also have to deal all these people who come in the name of help, but they just want to exploit you. There are also people like that. So you're dealing all these things. So it was really exhausting. To be honest, right now, when I look back, I'm thinking, like, how did I survive? It must be God. That's how I see it.
Hmm. And it was also exhausting, I can imagine, having to move from place to place, Could you talk about that, about the kind of different houses that you lived in, and the cycle of squatting, being evicted, and then not having a house in between, having to call around, all of this. Can you talk about that?
It was really, really bad. And this is the time where you see people are really panicking. The real trauma that is within them is coming out. Because when you have to move, then you remember the reason why you came here, the reason why you ran away from all that. And then you're also moving to another neighborhood, and you don't know how this neighborhood can react, because you've also had encounters where another neighborhood did not react well. You understand that? Where people don't want you to come into their neighborhood because somehow they see you like some kind of criminal.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Also, we don't want you in our nice white fenced neighborhood because you are a criminal. Well, if I was a criminal, then why am I not in jail? I mean, of course I am in jail. You created this invisible jail around me that I cannot break through. So you get scared. You are really scared. I mean, you're in a flight and fight mode. You understand that? And that is what is carrying you through all this. But deep inside, you are so scared. You're so scared. And then in between, you don't even get recuperation. A little bit of break, you don't get it. You're dealing all these things, and then you come to a place, and then you stay for 3 weeks or 2 weeks or a month, and then you have to move. But even when you're staying there, you have to plan ahead. You have to still find a place.
Mm.
So you're in this constant state of movement. And this is not a choice. You understand that? You did not choose, oh, I'm going to just go and backpack around Europe, you know, with my bag. That is a choice. That's a luxury. That is a privilege. This has nothing to do with privilege. This has nothing to do with choice. It is a survival at its worst way. But you have to deal it. You have to deal it, because otherwise, what else can you do? You have to survive it. So you move, you go through that.
And when an eviction, for example, would come closer, what would you concretely do?
You have to think what you're going to do. How are you going to move? A lot of supporters will come, and you have to talk to them, plan with them. Where am I going to put my luggage? It's not that much sometimes, but sometimes it's much, because you have created a little room in the previous building that you had. So you have to find a way to move all these things. On top of that, you also have to find, okay, is the place that we are moving, is it big enough? Because even though we are in a community, you don't want someone to be on your face all the time. It will create a lot of friction.
Mm.
A lot of friction. If you don't have a place where you can just take a break, sleep by yourself, you know, then it becomes a problem. The smallest thing can become like a very big thing. And a lot of times, that's why there was a lot of fighting, you know. But then people say, oh, why are they fighting all the time? Do you see, that's why they are criminals? Hello. You have families. You live in a very privileged life. Still, you fight. Why are you fighting then? Just because your neighbors did not hurt you. But because we are like 100 people in a very small place that the neighbors hurt us, doesn't make us criminals. It just makes that we are in a very tight environment, in a very tight place.
And under a lot of pressure.
Yeah, with a lot of pressure. And you also have to deal with the police. Sometimes they come with this aggressiveness. I have to fight for my rights. You're not going to stop me. You're not going to stop me. You're not going to tell me, oh, I'm the police. I don't have guns. I'm not carrying weapons. I am demonstrating. And if you have a problem with that, then that's on you. It's not on me. You know? So you also have to deal with that. So it was really hard. It was really hard. And the thing is, it still is. A lot of times people think, oh, we are here. That was something, you know? But just because you don't see them demonstrating on the streets or being visible in the media like every week or something like that, does not mean that the problem does not exist. The problem exists bigger than it was before. Nothing has changed. And people still are put in this kind of situation again and again and again because the law did not change. Even when they say that we want to help you, they are not helping. It's more of a political move.
Yeah, you're mentioning already like these political responses. Can you say a little bit more about your experience with the political responses to We Are Here in the time that you were
from the municipality?
Involved? Yeah, from the municipality, different organizations.
The politicians in Amsterdam, especially the gemeente of Amsterdam, did not want to really deal with our situation. They always refer to us as if it was for the government to bring solutions. And so we became something that had to pounce in between the gemeente Amsterdam and the government.
Like a toy or a ping pong ball.
Yeah. So, oh yeah, we would like to help you, but we cannot help you unless the government finds a solution for you. That was the comment that came over and over again. But the thing is, of course, the government has to change policies and they have to make a situation for refugees much better than it is right now, because it really is not that good at all. But on the other hand, the gemeente of Amsterdam has also responsibility to do something about the situation of refugees within this gemeente, because we are living in Amsterdam gemeente.
Gemeente municipality,
yeah,
for our
the
English
municipality, yeah, the municipality of Amsterdam has to also to take responsibility. Especially in our housing situation, especially in our healthy situation, especially in how are we going to live? Because you cannot expect people to think about their future if they don't have a quality of life. It does not work like that. You cannot tell us, okay, we're going to give you a night shelter, just so that you can think about your future. How am I going to think about my future when the whole day I'm on the street? This is what actually was given by the gemeente Amsterdam.
So it's, I guess they provide shelter at night.
Yeah.
And then you have to leave and wander around the streets in the daytime.
Yeah. From 9 in the morning, you leave the premises of the night shelter and then you come around 6 in the afternoon. But what am I going to do in between? Where am I going to stay in between? How, where am I going to think my future in between? On the street bench?
Because that's, I guess, what they say. They say this way you can work on your future.
Exactly. They wanted to make being here in the Netherlands very hard. You understand that? But we're already here. I cannot go back. I have no way to go back. My country is still in a war. My country is still trying to rebuild after 30 years of war after war. Where am I supposed to go back? Or maybe I came from a country where I cannot go back because the moment I go back, I will be in jail or killed. There is a reason why I came here. That same reason is forcing me to stay this. So at least I am alive. That is what it is. At least I am alive. That is the reason why people are here. So for you to say, okay, I'm going to make it hard for them, that is on you. You understand that? It does not help the government and it does not help us. Sometimes I wonder the fact that they think that will help them. It's crazy.
It's beyond you.
Yeah. It's really crazy. That's not a solution. It's not a solution for them, and it's not a solution for us. So what are you doing then? You know?
Yeah, you said earlier that when you became more of a public figure within We Are Here, a lot of people started calling you, and a lot of people often also wanted a lot of you, like made a lot of demands on you, even though you were also struggling with your own trouble, as you said.
Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit about who these people were, what they wanted from you, what it was like to be getting all these demands from them, how you responded to them?
Well, it was actually a lot of different people. Some people came because of the media. So you have to deal with them because you also need the media. You also need to be visible in that. But then there's also other people who wants to donate. People who are in solidarity with you, who want to help you. They can be individuals. They can also be people who have organizations. But then there's also other people who come to exploit you. They have a certain project, and then they just come in the name of, oh, I want to help you. So, and how are you going to help me? Yeah, you have to tell your story. I've already told my story. It is all over. I mean, you can find every punctuation and commas in everywhere. But how are you going to help me? How is this project that you want to help me with is going to help me personally? You understand that? And then they're like, yeah, but you know, we just came here because we want to create more visibility for you. But it's one thing to create visibility, and we are doing that. We are all the time on the media. We are creating that for ourselves. But when you are making these projects or whatever, that you have acquired funds for it, that you are paying for yourself, and you are coming here, and then you wanna take my time, first of all, and then you wanna take my opinion, and you wanna take my energy, and in return, all you give me is feasibility that is exploitation. You understand that? And especially for people who should not be exploited. If I'm somebody who's working and who have hackery and stuff like that, and then you ask me, hey, will you like to be part of this project? We would like you to contribute. Then you can say, okay, fine, I can do that. But I'm struggling, how am I going to get my bread today? I'm struggling, how am I going to get toothbrush today? You understand that? Because I don't work. There's no work for me. There's no income of whatsoever that comes on my way. So for you to come, but at the same time, you never included in your project the resources that you're getting, that I should also get that resources back because it will help me now. Huh? Then that's exploitation.
Is that something that came up a lot?
It came a lot. People were coming from Belgium. People were coming from Germany. They were coming from Sweden, Canada. And they come with this form like, oh, yeah, we just want 1 hour or 2 hours or 5 hours of your time. How am I going to get my 5 hours of my time?
And like students, academics, yeah. Maybe people in art projects,
exactly.
filmmakers.
Yeah. And some people will come and say, okay, well, I would like you to come and talk to our students. Okay, I don't mind talking to them, but are you going to pay me?
And how do people respond?
And then all of a sudden they get shocked, as if I have asked the world for them. I don't even know how to describe it because I was like, how do you get shocked for me to ask that I be treated equally as you? Why does that shock you? And if that shocks you, what kind of help are you actually providing? You know?
Yeah, you have to fight to be seen as equal, as worthy of just equal pay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then there's also those other people who will come and say, oh yeah, we would like to pay you, but we cannot pay you because the system does not allow. Okay, here is the thing, madam. If the system does not allow me for you to pay me, then I'm not supposed to be with you. I'm not supposed to do anything with you. So, ciao, mevrouw. But even that one, they don't understand. And they go like, oh my God, they can say no. Or she can say no. She can say, I don't want this. And I'm like, what kind of a world have you been living? Do you think you're the only people who have no in their language or who can say, I don't want this in their language? Is that it? Or you think we are not capable of comprehending what is meant to say no or I don't want this, I'm not going to do this, I'm not interested in this? So you're also dealing with this kind of people, you know, all the time. Sometimes I'm like, what kind of a human being am I dealing with? You know, because I respect people. But when you're coming with this kind of mentality, you are not respecting me, you are disrespecting me. And this is something that you have to all the time fight for.
And it's also a lot of emotional labor for you.
Yeah.
To be put in this almost teaching role of teaching people how to treat you as a human being, teach you basic respect.
Oh,
I can imagine that's really exhausting
itself. It really was. It really was. And it was so bad that you get angry. You get angry and agitated at them. And then they just look at you like, oh my God, she got angry. Like, why is she getting angry?
Mm.
You know? I'm getting angry because you have no common sense. You have no common decency that a human being is supposed to have. That you did not understand that you're supposed to respect another human being, regardless of who they are or what, where they came from. You know? You don't need to go to school to learn 1 + 1 = 2. It is something that is in our capacity to think and imagine. There are a lot of people you see who have never been in school, but they just know how to count and how to, you know, subtract and do all kind of multiplication and subtraction and addition and all that. And they've never been to schools, but they understand because that is the common sense. It is what makes us an intelligent being. You know, but these people, I don't know where they put their common sense, or maybe they think because you are a black person or that you are not a European person, that you don't have the same common sense as them. So they come to treat you in this perverted way in their head that they think that you are. It's a perspective in their head that they think that you are.
Yeah, that they expect you to be grateful when they offer something that you actually see as quite little, given the situation you're in and the situation they are in.
Dehumanizing.
Dehumanizing, yeah.
Because you cannot give what you will not take for yourself.
Mm.
That is what respect is. Don't ever give something that you will not take for yourself. Otherwise, it's an insult. And when I react to that insult, don't look at me as if you're shocked. You know, and it has to do a lot with superiority complex. Mm. You know? And privilege. And then sometimes when you tell about your story, they go like, oh my God, you must be so strong, you know? And they're not saying that for a compliment. I swear to God, it's not a compliment. They are saying this because you are a black woman, you know? You are a black woman. You can deal all this shit. You can take all this shit. Because otherwise, me, white woman, I cannot deal all these things. I cannot take all this shit. So you are not like me. That's what it actually means.
Mm.
You are built different than me.
Mm.
You know, you are emotionally different than me. You are mentally different than me. You are not a human being like me. You must be some kind of an alien or something. You know, so that is discrimination itself. And they expect you to take it as a compliment. So when you stop them and tell them, listen, don't label me, don't discriminate me. And if you cannot mount compassion and empathy for my situation, please don't say anything about it. You know, then that also becomes another struggle. So all these things, you have to deal with it every day. And you're supposed to be sane. You're supposed to be calm. You're supposed to be a perfect human being. Because the moment that you're seeing being angry, or the moment you're seeing having argument or fighting, all of a sudden it becomes, oh, look at them, the criminals. We told you they are criminals, isn't it? Look at them, how they are reacting.
Yeah, then that's used as evidence that
exactly.
You're...
Exactly, yeah. My God, it was...
tiring.
Yeah, it was really tiring. But it was empowering. The fact that you can take your power back despite all that is happening, that you can go around and find a house and then squat it, that was so empowering. You're doing it for yourself, you know. And you also have all these volunteers who will come and help you, who will not look at you as all these other people have been looking at you, who actually wants to help you, you know, and work with you day and night, trying to find a house to squat with you and all that. And will even stand with you in front of the police. So that solidarity was also empowering. There was also respect among us, a sense of community that we had. We were not perfect. We fought a lot of times. we argued. But at the end of the day, we knew that we could depend on each other. You know, that I could go to any of the We Are Here groups, because we were divided, because the housing that we were getting was not big enough, that I could go any group and then get help from it. You know, that gives us also a sense of belonging. Yeah, but what was so amazing was that even though we came from different countries, from different walks of life, we respected each other as brothers and sisters.
Yeah, I noticed also when I heard you speak at demonstrations that then other people from We Are Here are really like, Mariama, go!
Yeah,
that's really beautiful to see.
But that's how we always treated each other. It didn't matter how hard we had or how bad the times were, or whether we fought like 5 minutes ago. But we had that strong connection of belonging to each other.
Can you maybe tell us about the time when you left We Are Here?
I left because I get sick. My health deteriorated really bad. I could not sleep. I could not eat. I was getting anxiety attacks. I was depressed. And my stomach could not digest food. And on top of that, I was also dealing with insulin intolerance. My cells will not take the food because of the insulin thing. So I was exhausted. I swear to God, I was really exhausted. And that's why I approached Joyce. I said, listen, Joyce, I need a place, just a room somewhere. I don't care where it is, that I can just, you know, be by myself. Because I needed a place where I could be with my thoughts, you know, to figure out what I can do for myself to help. I'm the kind of person, I don't like feeling helplessness. I'm more of a solution-orientated person rather than, you know, feel sorry for myself. And on top of that, I was like, I cannot afford to do that because I don't have my family here who will say, oh, something's going, we need to help her. I don't have nobody who will think of me that way. So I had to think that way because sometimes it was too much. People were killing themselves, doing suicide. And we are here also because the situation was getting too much. So sometimes if you don't find a solution out of it as quickly as possible, you can just quickly slip into a very bad depression where it may lead you in a very bad places. And I knew if I did not get out, if I did not find help, then I'm gonna be there.
I think about that quite a lot, about the just the extreme violence that's in illegalization, in making people illegal and putting people in the situation that you've been describing of not being able to work and at the same time not providing anything, like pushing people into the streets.
Just also not feeling safe.
And not feeling safe and everything you've been talking about, just the extreme violence of that. Yeah.
So I needed to get out. That's why I approached Joyce and I told her, you have to help me to find a place. And that's how she approached you. And I get a room by your community.
How did you experience that time at our place? Did it give you some rest?
It gave me some rest. It gave me a time to be with myself. And I needed that because that's the most important thing, you know, for a person. That's you get a time to be with yourself, to really think. Because I could not hear my voice in that place. And it's not because of the we are here, but because of everything that was going around. I was dealing all that and I could not hear myself. I could not hear myself. I could not feel myself. So I was depressed, you know. I'm still dealing right now. As I'm sitting here, I'm still dealing with it. I'm still dealing with anxiety. Sometimes I get these anxiety attacks and I think I'm dying. Oh my God, I'm dying, you know. Because I'm still dealing with the trauma. I'm still dealing with the pain and the suffering and the struggle that subjugated me to that life. I'm still dealing with it. Even though I have status right now, even though I have my one-bedroom studio, I am a better place than I was, but I am still dealing with it.
I can also imagine, because when did you get your status?
2018.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was around the time...
That I get out.
That you got out, right?
Yeah.
And I can imagine it happened to more people, right? Because a lot of people from We Are Here at some point got status after being in an illegalized situation for sometimes a decade, like many years.
Yeah.
And the whole idea of We Are Here is collective resistance and is, as you mentioned, like taking back power through community, through collective resistance. Of course, everyone also works on their case because in the end you need to live and you need to get out of that traumatized, traumatizing situation. But then you will never get out of it as a group at the same time. And that splits people up.
It does.
But it's an effect also of that, of the system in that sense. And I can imagine it's a really hard situation
really
also.
Is, it was not easy for me to leave them. It's still not easy for me to leave them. I still feel bad, the fact that they're still in the same situation. And I get out, I still feel that. And I still feel guilty about it. I'm not supposed to, but I do because I care about them. You know, I care about them because I know what they're going through. I know what they have been through and the situation that they're still in. On the other hand, you are in a very bad place that, like for example me, that if I did not get out, then I don't know if I would be sitting here today, you know, talking this. Because I was really, really in a very bad place. And even when I came back and I sit in those meetings, I'm coming here, I'm sitting there and we are talking about the meeting and stuff, but I'm looking at everybody's faces and I feel even more hopeless. I feel more sad. I feel more heartbroken. I feel like I'm reliving the same trauma over and over again. So I had to stop even coming to meetings. You know, I had to really stop it
Yeah, I mean, the situation is traumatizing for a lot of people, to being legalized and being seen as illegal and living that life. So I can imagine when you get out that it's re-traumatizing almost to be back in that situation.
Yeah, it really is. You have no idea how much I miss them. But then afterwards, because I see them still in the same situation, I will have that day 3 times anxiety attacks. Or that night I will have 2 times anxiety attacks. And I will not sleep. I cannot pray. I cannot meditate. I will be undoing everything that I have been doing for a whole month because of it. That's how traumatized I am, still am, about the situation.
And I think a lot of the Dutch people don't understand that the system that we have put in place causes trauma.
Yeah.
But that's the trauma that a lot of people are living with.
But also, like, even when you go to doctors, whether it is psychiatry or psychotherapy, when you go there, you cannot actually relate to it.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's in a group or anything, you cannot relate to it. And how can you give a voice to your emotions if that voice does not exist in the environment that you are in? You understand that? So
it takes energy again.
Yeah, it takes energy. Yeah. It takes a lot of energy, but also an energy that you don't have because you already overexhausted yourself.
Yeah, and it's the same kind of energy you've had to give all that time where you put in the role of explaining it every time, and now you're explaining it again.
Exactly, yeah. So you have to explain yourself all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The kind of draining you describe from having to explain your situation all the time, it reminds me of the work of James Baldwin, a writer.
Yeah.
And a civil rights activist from the US.
Yeah.
And in the 60s, he gave a lot of speeches. And he also went into kind of debates with all kinds of people. For example, like young white conservative students. And there's like really powerful videos of him online where he conveys the despair he feels when he has to, again, bridge what he calls like the gap between one person and another.
Yeah.
Whereas from the moment he was born, every single like moment of his life, he's lived in a different reality from the person across from him.
Yeah.
And he has this, and I recognize it in you also, but this way of showing them just how radically different they've been living their lives. And he's the one who has to bridge that, because the other person is living in their ignorance, and that's comfortable. They don't have to bridge that. They didn't have to do that emotional labor.
But that's what's wrong with the world, isn't it? This lack of questioning ourselves, you know? Like, what are we doing, you know? How am I perceiving another human being? How am I seeing another human being? You know, like, my life is so perfect, so I don't have to think outside my walls. I'm just comfortable, so I don't have to think about other people. Or it has to be easy in the sense that I don't have to think about it. Oh, let me just give you this money, you know. And this is also what's wrong with all these organizations that go around the world giving help to other people, you know. When you just, you know, take a bread and then you give them, you are not actually helping them. You're just saying, okay, I don't want to see you hungry, you know. I have done my responsibility. And this is what's wrong with the world. You understand that? Look at what is happening, like, for example, a continent like Africa. You know, most of the resources in the world is coming from it. And people don't have clean water. How is that possible? How is that possible? Where is the resources? Huh? The Western country is vanishing with it. Huh? Building up, having the best infrastructure and everything. While the black kid in Africa does not even have a clean water, then there's exploitation, isn't it? Then it is your responsibility, it is your fault that you are living a perfect world while he is not living a perfect world. But they don't want to understand. Oh, no, I did not do that. You know, I did not take that wealth. Hello? If you did not take, your grandfather took it. You inherited from him, and you're still inheriting it. So it is your fault.
Yeah, and you're even inheriting it through through the roads, through the schools, through the...
You're inheriting it. You're still inheriting it. So you cannot say it's not my fault, you know. And that thinking capacity is what lacks. When I see the Western candidate, this is what lacks, except few people. And so how are we going to create a better world? Do you want to continue this world where some people have privilege while others don't have it? I have a Dutch passport, so I can travel all over the world. Some even I don't need visas. While if I had my own passport, a Somalian passport, I should have a lot of money in order for me to travel. Do you see the injustice, the inequality? If this kind of inequality exists, then you will never feel safe. Maybe today you have a perfect world, but you never know what you can have tomorrow.
Yeah, what I really like about also in some of the speeches that you made during the demonstrations, you really make the point of saying no one can tell no one where to go or where to live, and no one's going to tell me whether I'm going to live or not. I'm going to live.
Do you know why I say that? I was born in a war. I remember one day, this is my earliest memory, right? I was 2 years old, and I've never told this, but I'm going to tell you today why I say that. We were in this small village. We actually moved from the city because there was a lot of war. So we came to this village where my auntie was living. And then the war caught up with us. One morning, the men ran away. Because if they see only women, then they will leave us. But what happened was they did not leave us. My mom later told me. Because I only know my mom was crying. And I asked my mom, "Mom, I have this memory, but I don't understand it." So my mom explains to me in this way. And then she said, when they came around us. And then they put in a line, all the women and their children in a line. And my mom is crying. Every woman is crying and they're begging. I'm crying, not because I understand fear, but I'm crying because my mom is crying. All the children are crying. My mom is begging. All the women are begging. And then they turn around the car so that the machine can face us. When it was about to actually, you know, do whatever they wanted to do, you know, machine gun everybody in the line, another car came in a very high speed. And then it comes and says, "Let's go, let's go, let's go, because we are needed back in the front." So they left us. In a split of a second, we were spared. That's why I'm sitting today here. Do you understand that? If it was up to a man for me not to exist, I would have died that day. And I would not be sitting here today. The fact that somebody thinks it's up to somebody for them to exist, that is a wrong idea. It's a wrong mindset. You understand that? And that's why I don't believe that it's up to you for me to be in this existence. It's up to nobody. I came here just like everyone else came. And that's why when I say what I say, it comes from there.
From that place.
Yeah.
And I think we have one final question, and that is for our listeners. Basically, if people listening want to get involved in helping, supporting, or being in solidarity with people without papers, what could they do?
First of all, when you want to help somebody, ask yourself what kind of help if you were in that situation. If you had nothing, leave about even bare minimum. If you had nothing and you were in that situation, how will you like to be helped? But if you cannot imagine that, if you cannot put yourself in that shoes, ask the person. Come to them and ask them, what can I do? How can I help you? If you have a project, before you even make the plan of the project, come to those that you want to make the project for. Ask them, what do you need? How can I make this project? And how can it benefit you? Because then you are actually treating people with respect and equality and justice. But when you come with this kind of white savior, "Oh, I'm here to help you, to save you," while you are not saving nobody. People have the capability to save themselves, but what they need is help. So can you be the medium for that? And the only way you can be the medium to help them is by asking them what they need, how they need it, what you can do for them, and how that can impact them in their life. So in that way, it becomes more empowering. Imagine if I'm an asylum seeker or a refugee, undocumented, and there's all these projects or organizations that come. Imagine if they donate capital for my time. That will empower me, right? That will help me in my survival. It will also empower me because I feel like I am worth of something, that I'm treated equally, that my contribution is valued. The same way that every person who works, whatever work they do, they are supposed to be paid, it should be paid. That's it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here today.
Before closing this episode, we would like to thank a few people, collectives, and organizations. B. Carrot for the illustrations we use on our Instagram and other social media accounts. Thomas from Dark Roast for the graphic design. Joris and David and Ellen and Neska and Shane Ivers for the music. The MKZ Binnenpret for allowing us to have the space to record most of our interviews. And the Van Vollenhoven Institute and the Institute for Cultural Anthropology and Development Sociology of Leiden University, Leiden University Fund, and the Netherlands Organization for Scientific Research for the financial support. If you have any thoughts on this episode that you'd like to share with us, please get in touch through our Instagram, Twitter, or email.